Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Monica Brady Meyerov in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Obama is fleshing out the details of an idea he hinted at in the State of the Union address on Tuesday. At the University of Michigan this morning, Obama outlined a proposal that would reward colleges that keep tuition costs down and shift federal dollars away from colleges that don't. It would also require colleges to provide a report card so parents and students can more easily compare financial aid packages and determine the value of a degree.
From now on, parents and students deserve to know how a college is doing. How affordable is it? How well are its students doing? We want you to know how well a car stacks up before you buy it. You should know how well a college stacks up.
Student loan debt now tops what people owe on their credit cards, but the president's plan makes some in the higher education industry nervous. Joining us on the line is Tamar Lewin, who covers education issues for the New York Times. And Tamar, how would this linking of aid to tuition work?
Well, this would make colleges that want to offer things like Perkins loans and work-study programs, it would make them show that they were doing a good job of keeping their tuition, their net tuition, affordable and serving these students.
So it would provide more work-study opportunities for students and more Perkins loans in colleges that had lower tuition and less so for colleges whose tuition cost was deemed too high?
It would take away their eligibility to offer those at all, yeah.
And there would also be a report card. You call it a shopping sheet for parents and students to really understand these college costs. As the president says, it's currently not easy to do. What information would it provide?
It would provide a lot of information, and in fact, it even goes beyond shopping sheet. For one thing, it would show what students really typically come out with in debt and how many of them graduate. But he plans to go way further and compile how graduates do. Do they get jobs? How much do they earn? And how much do they come out owing at the end? How are they doing repaying? That's a big step forward.
And the president also had a new idea about how to encourage states to invest more in public higher education, involving competition similar to the race to the top proposal that he's used in elementary and secondary education. Explain his proposal.
Well, the administration is very proud of Race to the Top in the K-12 world, where they had a competition for grants, and they were able to leverage money by getting lots and lots of people to adopt their agenda to try to get these grants. Now they want to do the same thing for states in terms of their public education affordability. So they want to have a $1 billion competition, a Race to the Top for colleges, that would show that they have made reforms that are keeping affordability up and doing better about getting more kids to graduate on time.
And where would this money come from? Would this be new funding?
Well, there we have a sticking point.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the only one. He also wants a new $55 million competition for individual colleges to fund their new efficiency ideas. But at this economic juncture, I don't know how much extra money there's going to be in there.
This plan, all these plans, would need congressional approval, so it's all very much up in the air. But if it's approved, do you think these ideas would really keep tuition down? Would people notice the difference?
Over time, they would have an effect. I don't think there's any quick fix. And there are some real concerns, like most state universities are having to raise their tuition because they're getting so much less money from the state. So a lot of people are saying, wait, it's not fair to penalize states like California, where they've had these huge cuts in funding, by telling them if they don't raise their tuition to make up that, that's the only way they'll be able to keep getting more aid. To lose the state funding and the aid, a lot of people say, is just unfair.
And what about the unintended consequence that may come with this? One listener tweeted us to say that he likes that the president is addressing high costs, but he worries that pulling federal money may have unintended consequences. And he writes that if they can't actually freeze their tuition costs, they'll lose federal funding and then have to hike the tuition even further. Might this happen?
Well, there's kinds of unintended consequence possibilities, like what about, you know, we go more and more to adjuncts, or we go to bigger and bigger classes, or worse and worse quality. But I think the real college worry is how much intrusion by the federal government should there be on what they do. And they immediately leap to call anything like this a price control and fight it tooth and nail.
By the way, what would be considered an affordable tuition under this plan? I mean, room and board at public universities is now an average of $17,000 a year. And for many, that's not easily affordable. And then you look at private colleges, costs $50,000 a year. Master's degrees can cost $150,000. So is the government going to be determining what is a fair cost for college?
Well, they're not setting any, this is what the tuition should be. And they are talking not about the published sticker price that people publish, but about the net tuition, which is how much people actually end up paying once you consider their grants and their scholarships and everything. And that's the measure they're going to be using, is net tuition. So those really expensive private colleges where it may cost 50-something, most of them are also very, very generous in their aid. So they wouldn't be penalized for having a sticker price of, you know, $54,000 if they give free tuition to everybody with an income of under, you know, $80,000.
Tamar Lewin covers education for The New York Times. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
But what happens when the college courses are free or nearly free? John Marcus of the nonpartisan and nonprofit education news site, The Hechinger Report, is with us in the studio. And John, you're writing about just that, the growth of free or cheap courses online. But before we get to that, you cover education. What's your reaction on the president's proposals?
Well, as Tamar Lewin said, universities fight tooth and nail against proposals of this nature, and it's not the first time this one in particular has come up at the federal level. But the government is now spending somewhere in the neighborhood of $50 billion on Pell Grants. That's direct grants, not loans, for university students. And some critics of increases in tuition believe that the more the government spends for this, the more entitled universities feel to increase their costs. It is an important leverage that the government has.
And you're also reporting that states are already doing things to try to bring down the cost of education. Tell us briefly about some of those.
Much more likely than any changes occurring at the federal level are changes that are occurring at the state level relative to public universities. And these are underway in many states already: South Carolina, Tennessee, Ohio, Illinois. They have instituted what's called performance-based funding. And this is a re-emerging phenomenon that's been going on over the last few months, and you're going to see it over the next few years, whereby universities are funded based on outcomes. Currently, most public universities are funded by the states based on enrollment. So if you recruit a certain number of students, that's the basis of your budget. It doesn't make a huge amount of sense because a lot of those kids basically don't finish and they don't graduate, which is the outcome, as the way that most other products and commodities in our society are rewarded are, you know, did you succeed? So these states are now allocating budgets based on what proportion of those students graduate, how many are retained one year to the next, how much does the university have an impact, a positive impact on the economy, and measures such as that. Those are very popular these days and much more likely to be implemented.
Well, now let's talk about what's new now, this new free and nearly free courses that's really challenging the traditional model of higher education. Explain it for us.
Well, this is another reaction to this extraordinary price sensitivity to these very, very high costs of higher education. There's a great deal of material now online that's publicly available for free. It's part of what's called the open courseware movement that was pioneered in the United States in 2002 by MIT and also has been underway for even longer than that in the rest of the world, making courseware available, including even videos of lectures by very prestigious academics for people who might not otherwise have access to universities. In the last 2 years, a number of startups with very prestigious backing by organizations like the Hewlett Foundation and Mozilla, which runs the Firefox browser, have begun to assemble that material into curricula and teach it as if you are studying toward a degree using free online content. They've had very, very small numbers of Americans enroll in these because they are almost impossible to transfer credit. And if you can't transfer the credit from a free online course to a traditional university,
you don't get a degree.
You can't earn a degree. And if you can't earn a degree, then an employer is not going to look at you.
Right. Well, just to be clear, though, you're not talking about for-profit online colleges that we've seen explosive growth in, like the University of Phoenix. You're talking about places like Peer-to-Peer University, also called P2PU, and the University of the People that sort of stack these free courses together to create a degree?
Yes, that's right. These private for-profits actually cost as much or more than traditional nonprofit brick-and-mortar universities. The reason that they're very popular is they teach courses at night, on the weekends, and close to where their students live, which is a model that, frankly, traditional nonprofits might consider emulating. The last time you've been on a university campus on Friday, I defy you to find a class in session. So what these not-for-profits are doing is aggregating this free online material. And the milestone moment we've arrived at in the last few months and again in the next few months is that they've come up with a new kind of credential to do an end run around the university's monopoly on academic credit. They've created things like electronic portfolios, which University of the People will introduce next month, and something called badges, just like the Boy Scouts get, which should purportedly show that you've successfully completed a free online course. And you can take an aggregation of these badges to an employer and say, look what I've learned.
And some employers are accepting those. But who's grading these courses? Who's certifying that you've actually done the work to a certain degree?
Well, the biggest new entrant into this field is MITx, which is an initiative announced last month by MIT, wherein they take all of their online material and they allow you to take the material and then prove that you've completed it. And they will give you, well, they will sell you a completion certificate. MITx has not yet explained exactly how they'll determine that you've successfully completed the course. In other words, how they'll grade you. But once they manage to figure that out, if you've taken a bunch of MIT courses and you've completed them and MIT has certified that you've completed them, and you take those to an employer as opposed to some expensive private university somewhere, you're in. An employer doesn't care.
Well, what about conventional colleges and universities? There must be a lot of pushback to this idea.
Huge amount of pushback. The universities have used their control of academic credits to keep these programs from expanding. And since they won't take these credits, University of the People, for example, has enrolled 1,100 students in 2 years. Even the existing traditional nonprofits have online courses. They have 6 million students registered for online courses. They have to pay for those courses. But compared to that, these startups have in the few hundreds and thousands. So it's still really at the very early stages.
But just briefly, do you think that it's business and their acceptance of these degrees that may determine the success of this new venture?
I think that universities have been very slow to understand the reality that they are, as you referred to them earlier, industries, and that they are selling a commodity and that people are no longer willing to pay as much as they want to charge. So, yes, I think that these things have terrific potential.
John Marcus of the nonpartisan and nonprofit education news site, The Hechinger Report. John, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Just ahead, the BBC's Gabriel Gatehouse reports on human rights abuse allegations in Libya. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back. 3 months after the ouster of Muammar Gaddafi from power in Libya, there are growing concerns about the torture of prisoners there and questions about who is responsible for the mistreatment. Amnesty International says several people have died after being tortured in detention centers. And this week, the French medical charity Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, suspended its operations in the city of Misrata after treating more than 100 patients with what the group's general director, Christopher Stokes, called torture-related wounds.
From August, September, and especially from September onwards, we were seeing more and more people presenting themselves with clear signs of torture. And we've informed the authorities of this from the beginning and protested against this. And basically, we've had some unacceptable incidents, especially since early January, where we were somehow asked to provide medical care for people who had been interrogated and tortured and were then that same evening interrogated again and tortured, even though they needed attention in a hospital. Some of them could hardly walk, basically.
Joining us on his cell phone from Misrata is BBC correspondent Gabriel Gatehouse. Gabriel, the United Nations says there are more than 8,500 detainees in Libya. Who are they and who has control of them?
Well, I've just come out of the detention center that Médecins Sans Frontières ceased working in just the other day. And there are about 1,000 detainees in that one. Most of them say they have no idea why they're there. A few of them said they'd fought on the side of Colonel Gaddafi, but lots of them said they thought they were just victims of either racism, they'd been there because they were black Africans, who many of the rebels described or thought of as mercenaries fighting for Colonel Gaddafi, or they simply came from towns that were thought to have fought on the regime's side. So they're being held there, and we heard some really horrific tales of abuse. They're not alleging that the abuse occurred in that detention center. They rather say that some of them have been taken from that detention center to the army headquarters, some of them said, subjected to horrific beatings, some of them electric shocks, and then brought back, as you heard the MSF guy there saying, brought back for medical care.
Who is carrying out the alleged torture?
Well, it appears to be a mixture. In some cases, it looks like it's independent militia groups who abduct people and inflict the abuse. But some other prisoners were saying that the torture was occurring inside the building of the army headquarters. Now, I should say, I've just been to speak to the head of the military command here in Misrata. He flatly denied that there was any torture going on under his auspices. He said any wounds that I might have seen must have been related to the conflict, either from NATO airstrikes or from the fighting. That's something that MSF casts severe doubt on. They say the injuries are consistent with torture, not with war wounds. So there's a flat denial, basically, that there's any involvement on an official level here. But given the mounting evidence, I think those denials are looking quite feeble.
Gabriel, and we understand this alleged torture may be happening not just in Misrata. Earlier this week, you were in the city of Al-Shabiya, just south of Tripoli, and talked with some men who claimed to be tortured by a militia group. Tell me about that.
Yes, that's right. Well, this was after clashes erupted between that town of Al-Shabiya and the neighboring town of Gharian. It seemed to have been sparked by a very small disagreement between a group of young men, but soon escalated into fighting. Now, we understand that the militia from Gharian took over 20 men prisoner and tortured all of them. Certainly that was the allegation. I spoke to one of the men who had been tortured. He spoke of sustained beatings and being subsequent until he passed out. One of the other men who was captured by the same militia appears to have died of his injuries. I went to see his body in the morgue in Tripoli. It was very, very badly bruised indeed. And when I spoke to the nurse who was present at the autopsy, he said he believed he'd been subjected to sustained electric shocks.
So, Gabriel, the nurse told you the man had been subjected to sustained electric shock. What does the central government in Libya say, the National Transitional Council, about these charges? You know, they say they have a commitment to human rights, but as far back as October, human rights groups were warning that allegations of torture were staining the image of Libya.
Yes. Well, I mean, yesterday we spoke to the Justice Ministry, and they said that while they were worried about these reports coming out, both from Amnesty and from MSF and also the UN Security Council, they admitted they didn't really know what was going on. I mean, the problem for the central government in Libya at the moment is that this is still quite a fractured country. A town like Misrata, which is a 2-hour drive east of Tripoli, pretty much runs their own city. So there's a limit to what, at the moment, the authorities in Tripoli can do to stamp their authority on these kinds of situations. On top of that, there are all kinds of independent militias who are still armed, who are running about refusing to give up their weapons.
Well, in talking about these armed militias, is there any connection between these armed militias and the fighting that took place in Bani Walid this week and the claims of torture? Are there real fears that a civil war may break out again in Libya?
It's quite a complicated picture. If you take a city like Bani Walid, NTC forces, or at least some of them, said that what they were dealing with there was pro-Gaddafi counter-revolutionaries. Now, I went down to Bani Walid to check this out. I couldn't see the green flag of the Gaddafi regime flying over the rooftops, as some rebel fighters had claimed. However, it did seem clear that there was quite a large degree of support for Colonel Gaddafi's regime. In other places, we've seen two rival militias, either from neighboring towns or even sometimes from within one town, start fighting each other over sometimes very, very small issues. But because of the proliferation of weapons, people are quick to use violence and also very quick to accuse each other of loyalties to the old regime, loyalties to Colonel Gaddafi, even if that doesn't really seem to bear any relation to reality.
The BBC's Gabriel Gatehouse speaking with us from Misrata, Libya. Gabriel, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Monday on Here and Now, a new do-it-yourself recipe for methamphetamine is landing users in hospital burn units and putting a strain on healthcare resources. That's Monday. News is next, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, and by the Harvard Art Museums, from Chinese jades to Jasper Johns, Byzantium to Bernini. Learn more at harvardartmuseums.org. And by the Institute of Contemporary Art Boston, with Isaac Julian's 10,000 Waves, a 9-screen video installation featuring Maggie Chung, icaboston.org.
I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The GOP presidential candidates got downright feisty last night. Here's Newt Gingrich and Mitt Romney sparring over Gingrich's plan to allow some undocumented immigrants to live in the U.S. legally.
All I want to do is allow the grandmother to be here legally with some rights to have residency but not citizenship so that he or she can finish their life with dignity within the law.
You know, they're not 11 million. They're not 11. Our problem is not 11 million grandmothers. Our problem is, all right.
The candidates also took swipes at each other over their finances, health care reform, and negative campaigning. So how did it go over with Florida voters? Larry Schultz is a NASA project manager and longtime Republican politician, serving as a city council member and mayor for 34 years in Rockledge, along Florida's Space Coast. And Larry, what was your takeaway from the debate?
Kind of more of the same. There was sniping at each other. I think there was some discussion of issues. Immigration, for one, I think is a big issue in the state of Florida. We have a huge Hispanic and Caribbean population in our state. There needs to be something done on immigration and solving people who are here illegally.
Did you like what was said? Was there any candidate that struck you as having a position that you liked on immigration?
Well, I thought something along the lines of Newt Gingrich's proposals are probably something that would be applicable to the state of Florida.
You know, the space program is directly tied to jobs in your neck of the woods, where unemployment is just under 10%. And Romney called out Gingrich for his plan to have a human colony on the moon in 8 years, implying the former speaker was pandering to Florida voters.
If I had a business executive come to me and say they wanted to spend a few hundred billion dollars to put a colony on the moon, I'd say you're fired. We have seen in politics, Newt, you've been part of this, go from state to state and promise exactly what that state wants to hear.
Larry, how did that go over on the Space Coast?
Romney's comments, I think, would probably be received negatively. I think Newt Gingrich's conversations on this subject would be very exciting to the Space Coast.
Because it could mean a huge new program with a lot more jobs.
Absolutely.
You know, about 31% of Floridians who voted in the last presidential election were over 65. The candidates all have plans to change Social Security to some degree, either increasing the retirement age or reducing benefits for wealthier retirees or setting up private retirement savings accounts. But it doesn't seem like the candidates are talking about issues related to seniors.
I think there needs to be more discussion by the candidates on Social Security and what is really necessary to ensure that Social Security is going to be there for all of us in the future. You know, I've told my sons that they need to be planning their financial future without Social Security as being the mainstay of their retirement lifestyle.
Florida was one of the hardest hit areas when it came to real estate and the bubble bursting. What's the market like today, and what can the candidates do about it?
The real estate market in the state of Florida is terrible. Ever since World War II, Florida has been a growth state. We have lived off of people from up north moving to Florida for retirement and for work. This particular real estate crisis has hit every single section of the state of Florida very, very hard. I think it's going to take a change in the marketplace that's going to be very, very difficult to achieve. And I'm not sure that the Congress or the president can really do that.
Larry, can you give us a sense of what it's like to be a Florida voter right now with this barrage of campaigning?
Every single day we get all these telephone calls. We have caller IDs, so we're able to take and wade through a lot of them. But get a lot of mail every single day. Of course, the TV and the radio ads just add to the mayhem. I think we need to be sticking to the issues and forgetting the personalities.
You've been involved in Republican politics for 3 decades in Florida. How would you advise the candidates in the remaining days of this campaign before the primary?
I think the economy. How do we turn the economy around? How do we generate good, viable jobs without spending a lot of federal dollars?
Larry Schultz is a NASA project manager and longtime Republican politician from Florida's Space Coast. Thank you, Larry.
Have a good day.
Coming up, the new face of Facebook, here and now. Any day now, your entire Facebook life will become an open book. Facebook's timeline feature will soon become mandatory for its 800 million users. Timeline is sort of like a virtual scrapbook. It puts all of your status updates, photos, and friendships into an easy-to-scroll timeline. It also shows everything you've ever recorded in your profile over the years, from job history to relationship status. That information is already there, but privacy advocates are worried that now it's easier to find. Adam Clark Estes writes about media and technology for The Atlantic Wire. He joins us from NPR in New York. And Adam, the timeline will replace your current wall, and visually it's really more interesting. Larger photos, it has more of a blog layout, and it's easier to look through. It gives Facebook, I have to say, a facelift. But what do you think of it?
I'll be honest. You know, I've been on Facebook for a long time. I joined in 2004. And I've never been an incredibly avid user. I'm more of a Twitter guy myself. But since the timeline came out, I find that I kind of want to spend more time on Facebook. I kind of like the idea of writing my own autobiography and sort of curating my own digital scrapbook.
And that's a big part of the timeline, because if you want to keep control of it, you might want to cull out unwanted photos or old relationships or add information about jobs. Why is curating so important to the timeline experience?
You know, if you were at a party in 2005 and maybe there are some embarrassing photos taken, you need to kind of be aware of those and go back and be sure to either untag yourself or whatever you need to do. What the timeline does is make these moments stand out a little bit more. And so curation is a little bit more important because people don't have to necessarily rake through the past 6 or 7 years of updates to find those photos. They might get pulled up and automatically featured on your profile.
Well, that makes a lot of people concerned about privacy. And obviously, you can control that on Facebook, but it takes a lot of work. Is it the same with the timeline? You can still go out and cull anything you want at any time, but it sounds like it might be at least a little easier to find?
That's true. It's a little bit easier to find what Facebook would call important moments in your story. And for this reason, I think that it is really important that people look back in their timeline and see what's featured and curate their life story in a way that they want. The controls are there. You know, there are lots of levers to pull, and I think that Facebook has responded pretty assertively to privacy complaints. However, it's hard to forget Mark Zuckerberg's famous statement a couple years ago about the end of the era of privacy, about the future of Facebook being I don't want to say privacy-free, but he's certainly pushing us to rethink what privacy means online.
Well, in terms of privacy, the timeline also integrates Facebook apps like Spotify, which lets you listen to music via Facebook. But that could end up being a little embarrassing, right, Adam?
I can speak from personal experience.
Do you recognize the song?
I do.
It's Justin Bieber, Mistletoe. And tell me about how that ended up on your Facebook timeline.
So I was hanging out at my house, and I was, cooking a Christmas casserole or something, and happened to put on the Justin Bieber album. And I use Spotify, and I have kind of all my privacy features wide open, and so it went to my Facebook timeline. And I was a little bit surprised minutes later when I saw all my several friends commenting on how I was listening to Justin Bieber, and I was a bit red in the face.
So explain Spotify and why your friends were able to know you were listening to Bieber.
Well, the way Spotify works, it's deeply integrated into Facebook. Part of this, I would guess, is because Sean Parker has a close relationship with both Spotify. He's one of the primary investors, and he used to be the president of Facebook, as we all know from The Social Network. But Spotify wants to be a social music experience, and so when you have the default settings on, it immediately sends a stream of what you're listening to back to Facebook. This is an example of what Zuckerberg calls frictionless sharing. And like I said, when I signed up for Spotify, I went with the default privacy settings, and so all of my songs were pushed to Facebook. And this has been often fun because my friends can hear what I'm listening to and they can click it and listen to the same song. But much to my chagrin, when I listen to Justin Bieber, my friends know that I'm listening to Justin Bieber, and I'm not ashamed of listening to Justin Bieber. I just didn't necessarily realize that everyone was going to know I was doing it when I was in the privacy of my own home.
Well, Adam, it seems like part of the Facebook culture is that Mark Zuckerberg will change things and people will complain about it. But, you know, many of Here and Now's Facebook followers have been weighing in on this, and they seem to like the timeline. Gabby Weiss says, "My sister sent me a whole bunch of photos when we were kids, and I can now add them to my Facebook, and it makes my wall a lot more like a blog." And Jennifer Stake White writes that in terms of privacy, quote, "I don't get all the fuss. Then again, I never post anything I wouldn't want my mother or kids to see. So old posts coming to light is not an issue." That's probably a good rule to follow for all of us. But Reese Martin says, "I think it would be great if we had a little more control over the feeds, et cetera, such as how they're displayed and how they're refreshed." Do you find it's easy to control those sorts of things?
Easy is not a word I would use to describe control on Facebook. The timeline can require a lot of work. I've been on Facebook for several years, and if I really wanted to go back and curate my life story and make it look just like I wanted to, I think that it would take hours of going in and clicking hide this post or mark this an important post and feature it on the timeline. And I think that it's important to remember that you're kind of being tracked. I shouldn't say kind of.
You're being tracked.
And this is, I hesitate on that word because it's a bit fear-mongering. However, you do have control over it, and I think that it might take a little bit of work, and by default, companies like Facebook and Google want to know more information about you. However, if you don't want to share that information, there are things that you can do about it.
You say there are some positive aspects to the timeline as well, many positive aspects we've talked about, but especially for journalists. Explain that.
A really fascinating element of the timeline is to think about it as a way to tell a story. Let's take the Egyptian Revolution, for example. The Atlantic Wire has done a lot of coverage of the Egyptian Revolution, and we posted a lot of that to Facebook. And so if we could somehow use Facebook's timeline to organize that coverage in a way that makes it easier for people to understand the big picture of the story, I think that could be really fascinating. And, you know, based on recent news, I think that Facebook is interested in telling stories in a more journalistic way. News emerged yesterday that Facebook's hired a managing editor. He came from Time magazine, and I'm going to be really fascinated to see what they do with the news, and especially with regards to the timeline.
Adam Clark Estes of The Atlantic Wire talking to us about the new Facebook timeline feature, which all 800 million Facebook users will be forced to use in the coming days. Thanks, Adam.
Thank you.
Have you been listening to Justin Bieber on Spotify only to find that your Facebook friends know? Well, tell us about it and how you feel about Facebook's timeline feature on our Facebook page, facebook.com/hereandnowradio, and click the like button to be the first to know about upcoming stories. Before we go today, we leave Bieberland for Chesney Country with the Country Music Awards. Back in 1 minute, here and now. I'ma be under the mistletoe. Word on the street, Santa's coming at night. Reindeer's flying through the sky so high. I should be making a list. Welcome back. I need to live a little, have some fun, take some time, waste it on number one. That's Live a Little from country music star Kenny Chesney's latest CD, Hemingway's Whiskey. Chesney has reason to live it up. He led the field in the nominations for the Academy of Country Music Awards, which were announced yesterday, picking up 9. Jason Aldean, Brad Paisley, and Lady Antebellum also received multiple nods. Joining us to talk about the Academy of Country Music Awards is Wade Jessen, Senior Chart Manager in Nashville for Billboard Magazine. Welcome, Wade.
Nice to be with you, Monica. Thank you.
This seems to be Kenny Chesney's year. He took a year off from the road in 2010, but it seems to have paid off for him, right? He had 9 nominations, including Album of the Year and Entertainer of the Year.
Yeah, the fans missed him, and I think the industry missed him, and he wasn't entirely inactive during that time, but boy, when you look at this award slate, you can certainly see that he is back.
Let's talk about one of his songs, You and Tequila. It's sung with indie rocker Grace Potter of the band Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. You and tequila make me crazy. Run like poison in my blood. One more night could kill me, baby. One is one too many. One more is never enough. So, Wade, this song is nominated for the best song of the year. Tell me about it.
Well, the song of the year category is an award that goes to songwriters. And as you know, or may be aware, in Nashville, it's the song people that hold the gold. This is, above and beyond anything else, a song town. This song was written by a couple of our biggest female songwriters, Matresa Berg and Dina Carter. So this is a big night for them, too.
And most of the awards are voted on by the music industry, except for Entertainer of the Year and New Artist of the Year, which the fans vote on. And it seems that country music, more than any other of the awards, has this fan component locked in. Why is that? How are country music fans different?
Well, country music fans are very, very engaged with the artist. Their fans, to the degree of the artists, kind of become part of their family sort of thing. Country music fans are widely known to be very loyal. And so, you know, it really only makes sense when you consider that and the fact that so much music and media is driven by social media. That kind of interaction is a natural for fan voting. And the fans need to feel invested in the process, and this is just an incredible way for them to be able to do that.
I want to hear a little more of another fan choice for Entertainer of the Year. Here's Blake Shelton singing God Gave Me You. God gave me you for the ups and downs. God gave me you for the days of doubt. And for when I think I lost my way, there are no words here left to say it's true. God gave me you. Let's talk about another performer who got a lot of nominations, Jason Aldean, 6 awards. Tell me about his music. How does he distinguish himself?
Jason is an artist that speaks to people who love country music and live the country lifestyle. In other words, you know, when you hear his records, you're going to hear some pretty amped up country music, but you know, it's made to be played loud. It's made to be played live in arenas and stadiums. You know, he's not concerned about how his hair looks. It's a crazy town full of neon dreams. Everybody plays, everybody sings. Hollywood with a touch of twang. To be a star, you gotta bang, bang, bang. And no strings. He's very much ground level, gut level sort of country artist, and makes really incredible music. And he can do ballads. It isn't bad. I mean, you know, the duet with Kelly Clarkson is nominated, and, you know, he can do those kind of songs, but he's very much plugged into the younger end of the country music fan base that didn't necessarily just grow up on Johnny Cash records. Don't you want to stay here a little while? Don't you want to hold each other tight?
Don't you want to fall asleep with me tonight? Let's hear a little bit of the Brad Paisley duet with Carrie Underwood, Remind Me. This song has a country sound to it, and it's on Brad Paisley's album called This Is Country Music. But a lot of the songs that are on the charts today and that are being honored with the nominations have a very big crossover to it. Lady Antebellum, Kenny Chesney has many, Taylor Swift. Is that a trend that is continuing?
Well, I think it's an occasional thing for country music, to be perfectly honest. In the case of Taylor Swift, pop radio, contemporary hit radio found her and appreciated her not just for one or two songs, but I think really see her as an artist that fits with what they do. With Need You Now, I think they pop radio found a song in Need You Now that they felt like fit. I still think the jury is out a little bit on Lady Antebellum as to whether they'll have other big crossover hits, but you know, country, at least since the late 50s, seems to always occasionally show up on the pop charts. Sometimes there's a lot, sometimes there isn't any, but it's not often that we go through a year where there isn't some activity at pop radio for country artists. It's a quarter after one. I'm all alone
and I need you now. Country album sales dipped slightly last year, but it's still the most programmed radio format in the U.S. and growing. So what's the appeal? What does the country music format have that others don't, that come and go?
I guess the best way I could say it would be, you know, country music for the most part tells the truth. You know, one of our veteran songwriters many years ago, Harlan Howard, who is no longer with us, said that country music really is just three chords and the truth.
And yeah.
And he's pretty much right about that. I mean, It's a music that I think has done an outstanding job throughout its history of really covering the gamut of human emotion. Things have changed a lot. I mean, country music is not as much now a lifestyle music as it is just a choice of music.
What do you mean by that?
Well, country music does really well on the radio in places like Chicago and Boston and Los Angeles. Very successful radio stations in urban areas that don't necessarily have a big blue-collar population. So that's an old stereotype about country music that, in contemporary terms, just doesn't really hold up. A lot of people, almost everybody that you talk to, likes some country music. You might not find people that are fans of solid country music in their music diet, but there's some of it in almost everybody's music diet at this point.
I hear what you're saying. I like some country music, too, and let's go out on a song that I like. It's Camouflage by Brad Paisley.
All right, that's a great one.
Wade Jessam is senior chart manager for Billboard magazine out of Nashville. Thanks for talking with us, Wade.
No problem. Thank you. You can't blend in the country. You can't stand out.